everyone. Welcome to Let the Bird Fly, a podcast about living freely in a world given back to us. And that's how you do it, Peter, if you were wondering.
I was just thinking. I should remember that.
We're happy to be with you again today, as I will be able to participate a little bit more. Peter has given up the total reins for this episode, although I'm sure he will still have some thoughts for what I should say and share. We're excited to be talking to you today about a different topic. We're getting theological again, talking about what it is to be a confessing church. And we'll unpack that a little bit more as the episode develops. In the studio with me, as you heard, we have Peter Hermanson and Ben Leier. No guests today, no children, so just the three of us. It is still hot and I'm still fat, so the air conditioner is running in the office, but we have not had any complaints about the sound with that. So, once again, we're happy to have you with us here at Let the Bird Fly, as today we explore what it is to be a confessing church. Peter, would you like to take our disclaimer for us? I forgot about that.
This show doesn't speak for our churches, our church bodies, or our employers. To be honest, much of the time, it probably doesn't speak for us. We will be thinking out loud a lot, so approach what you hear with a healthy bit of skepticism. Because, well, as a responsible resident of planet Earth, that's probably what you should generally do with almost everything. If you find yourself getting too worked up, tune out, look around, and realize you are just listening to a podcast. That's right, a podcast. So go live freely, friends, and don't let us get in the way.
Peter, I thought we were amending the disclaimer to include any mention of the word voyeur. Did you did you forget to do that?
Oh, and yeah, how are we going to word that?
You understand that if the word voyeur is used, it's used in ignorance or with knowledge in a humorous fashion, but no one should Google it in any way act upon any definition they find. Or
should we maybe broaden that to just anything that Wade says?
Yeah.
Should not be Googled.
Understand, half the words I use I do not know. I just throw them out there. And with that, we will make our way, oddly enough, perhaps, into the scripture narrative. Scripture narrative today is going to come from St. Paul's epistle to the Philippians. I think this is the first devotion or scripture narrative we've had from the letter to the Philippians, if we are correct. We've not spent much time in the epistles, as we've tried to stick more with gospel narratives from Matthew, Mark, the chief gospel, Luke, or John, which isn't so bad, but isn't Mark. We'll be reading then first from Philippians. This is chapter 1, verses 12 on. Paul writes, "I want you to know, brothers, that what has happened to me has really served to advance the gospel, so that it has become known throughout the whole imperial guard and to all the rest that my imprisonment is for Christ. And most of the brothers, having become confident in the Lord by my imprisonment, are much more bold to speak the word without fear. Some indeed preach Christ from envy and rivalry, but others from goodwill. The latter do it out of love, knowing that I am put here for the defense of the gospel. The former proclaim Christ out of rivalry, not sincerely, but thinking to afflict me in my imprisonment. What then? And here is the key point. Only that in every way, whether in pretense or in truth, Christ is proclaimed. And in that I rejoice." And our episode today will be focusing on that. What the church is here for, what it has to give, what its chief task should be, and namely, that is confessing Christ and Him crucified for sinners. There's some words in there that we will pick up on, how the church will approach these things, and maybe some things that the church easily falls into, but it would like to avoid. But at the end of the day, we might successfully, as a church, succeed in leading people to avoid certain sins as much as they have before. We might succeed in trying to influence the culture in some moralizing manner. But the church ultimately fails if at the end of the day we are not about Christ and the gospel, because it's that and that alone which saves sinners and through which they are declared saints and brought into a new life in eternity. And as we've mentioned so often in the podcast, it's that which also gives the world back to us now as gift to be a joy, to be enjoyed, and that we might then live in the peace and confidence of the gospel of salvation achieved and given for the benefit of our neighbor as mass of God in our vocation. So we'll get into that after the free-for-all more today, but we will just echo Paul's concern that in all things what really matters is that Christ is proclaimed, whatever the motives behind those who do it, and when the gospel is given, we rejoice that sinners receive the forgiveness of sins and life eternal. And so with that, we will make our way into the free-for-all for today.
And we're back for the free-for-all, where we wrestle with the pressing questions of life and try to answer them once and for all. Our topic for today to discuss is, do modern comforts make us superior to our ancestors, or do they simply make us soft? So the softest one in here, Wade, why don't you start us off?
I think it's an interesting topic to examine, because one of the things I oftentimes will point out to my students is just the sheer volume of things that are at their disposal. They have more music at their disposal than the greatest kings of all of history could have mustered. They can appreciate more works of art than the greatest traveler in Europe in the Middle Ages, or pretty much Enlightenment, early modern period, any of this, could have enjoyed. They have access to greater libraries than the librarians at Alexandria or at Wolfenbüttel or at Oxford in the past. They have access to the world as a whole, understanding other cultures and making contact with people from other countries than any, you know, great merchant who traveled around the world trading spices or clothing, whatever the case might have been. And as Christians, they have more access to the scriptures, whether it be an audio book, whether it be on their phone, or whether it be a printed book that doesn't cost a year's salary, than ever before. And I then point out that perhaps we're less literate, we're in many ways less aware of our neighbor, oftentimes less appreciative of music and the arts than most generations to have gone before us in modernity. And so I'm going to come down pretty hard on the capabilities are just amazing, even for research now. I've been working on a couple pamphlets, treatises, I guess, by one of the confessors of the Formula of Concord, and then Matthias Flacius, going back and forth on Original Sin. And all I had to do was go online and get into some digital archives that I knew. I didn't have to go over to Germany, and I could dig at them. Yet at the same time, I would have to say, there's so much out there that I should be digging into, and instead I find myself on my computer for ESPN or social media or puppy videos, whatever the case may be.
Wait, have you been introduced to Facebook yet? Are you familiar with this?
Just a little bit, yeah, yeah. I might have a little bit of a footprint there, and it does amaze me, you know, how much you get sucked into. One of the things, I mean, one of the great blessings is some of the best friends, especially professionally, that I've come to make when it comes to shared interests in theology or history would not have been possible without that, right? I have people I can bounce ideas off of that I otherwise never would. But yeah, then I do partly because we have a lot of people who have friended me because of the show or things of this nature, but also just people who have read stuff, I've written stuff like that. There's a lot of people I wouldn't know them from Adam, but somehow now their opinion matters to me because it pops up on Facebook. So I would say that is a, you know, I think that does make me soft, because, you know, back in the day, maybe someone said something to you in the bar you didn't like, and you'd either brush it off or, you know, I don't know, break a beer bottle over their head. but now we get all wound up that, you know, someone didn't like, you know, something I had to say on some whatever.
And when you get upset in front of your computer, if you break anything, it's only your stuff that breaks. It's not their head. So
I want to know, you must not consider breaking a beer bottle over somebody's head to be getting wound up, because you just said you get all wound up on social media. But in the past, in the good old days, you would have just...
I think you just worked it out that way. Yeah. Yeah. I've never had a beer bottle broke over my head, but I have a feeling, I'd be like, I understand now, you disagreed with me.
It would be a pretty clear sign.
Yeah.
Yeah. I haven't had a beer bottle broken over my head either. I hope that that's not a terribly common thing outside of the movies, but because it seems like it would hurt.
Yeah, we do in the Johnston house. We like to take empty 2-liter bottles and have wars where we beat each other with those. But the plastic tends to have a lot of give to it, so it doesn't really hurt. And I think the glass is what would potentially be dangerous. But I mean, this is how I picture people working things out, in the past.
Well, I'll say that I don't disagree with your general premise that there's so many advantages that we have, but they do seem to make us soft. I remember there's an economist that I read one time, and he talked about how people used to use the difference in travel that people used to experience. The richest king, or the poorest peasant, I think he started with the lowest. So the poorest peasant had no horse or anything. He hoped he had shoes, and he would and he'd walk. He had his legs. And the richest king had
hopefully had legs.
Yeah,
I think less people had legs back then than now. I mean, they were born with them probably, but I think that a lot of people lost them at some point.
You think that was like an epidemic?
Maybe beer bottles. I don't know. Sorry, go ahead though. So there's peasant with legs.
Yeah,
and
he's
maybe
got
shoes.
Legs. And then there's the king or the wealthy, the wealthy tyrant, of course.
Who also has legs?
He also has legs, okay. But he also has a carriage and four horses, carriage and four.
And then horses have legs?
The horses all have legs. They have more legs, too. It's maybe not fair. And then you fast forward to, past the Industrial Revolution, you have the invention of the automobile, and you very quickly see...
Go Detroit.
And Ford, right? Because the point is you very quickly see the automobile for the peasants, right? And so that relatively poor people, families, can have a car. Now, it's true...
And just to be clear, American automobile manufacturers did this, not whatever it is you're driving now.
Well, there's always a process. Things are always changing. Yeah. But the king has he drives a real nice limousine or rides a nice limousine, but he's still in a car. And his point was just that the change. I mean, this has been a huge change, but the bigger change is certainly for those on the bottom. So this is like a rising tide lifts all boats, that kind of concept.
It's kind of like if you do a tour of Capitol Hill and use the bathroom, like everybody is using the same bathroom, right? The great unifier.
That's right.
You ever go to Washington? That's my thought when I. Like I bet a senator has been in here before.
That's interesting.
And some of them probably a lot, given what they're full of. I'll let you keep going, Peter.
My point is that so there's definitely progress that's kind of pulls up, and yet at the same time you see the king is more and more luxury. I mean, it's in a way we're kind of becoming softer as we advance. So I look back and think I can't imagine living without running water, without electricity. And yet, it seems like everything would be a little slower, and maybe I would I'd be a little less likely to break beer bottles over people's heads.
You can get the plague.
I suppose there's that.
Where do you on your scale of things improving, where do you put Spirit Airlines?
I've never flown Spirit Airlines. So
is that like a step back or
So yeah, that's a good question, Ben, because you've got airlines. Actually, you could make the argument that they're regressing, right? That it's becoming less soft.
That's my point. I just use as an example. You could pick any of them, but
Southwest. I like Southwest.
They stuff you in there like sardines, yeah. And it might be more efficient, but I don't know how long ago. You could have traveled across the country. Somebody help me out here by train. I don't know when.
Probably
the first
about 8 hours.
And you could see the countryside, and you could take in a lot. And now you just some of traveling is strictly utilitarian, and they'll pack in as many people as they can.
Sure, it's a little bit like Lord of the Flies when you get in there.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? All right, everyone, now's the time. Who's going to be the
Piggy
leader?
Piggy breaks his glasses.
That's right.
The I did see that. Is it the FAA? The government just approved or issued a study of the size of plane seats with the rationale that A, they are convinced plane seats have gotten smaller, and B, this is a problem because Americans have gotten bigger, some might say softer. and I will say, last time I went to, when I flew to Croatia with Pastor Borderland, we got economy, and we hadn't realized that now there's like economy and economy plus. And so I was thinking, like all the other times I'd gone to Europe, that economy was just economy. And it turns out now economy plus is what economy was, and economy is shrunk even more. And so Pastor Borderland and I, who are, you know, for the most part, pretty fit guys, we're walking down the aisle, and we see our seats, and we're both put in the same row with a guy from Belarus. I don't know how you say it, but and we just, you know, apologized and said, you know, we're very sorry, but you just got stuck with the American stereotype. You got two fat Americans, and it's going to be 8 hours of getting to know each other. And he just kind of, like, curled up comfortably and slept against the window the whole way. And we got off. He was real friendly with us. We got along great. But, you know, that's just a long time to be spilling over onto other people. And so I'm very sensitive to the – I do think the plane seats are – you know, I just, if I die, I don't want to die with, like, my love handles up against some stranger over the armrest, you know. And the armrest drives me nuts, too, because who does it belong to?
That is always,
you know,
the question.
I like the aisle, so obviously that one is mine, but I also think the other one should be mine if I'm bigger than the person that's next to me.
Well, and with the whole question of modern comfort, too, you can say that it's made us soft, but what are you going to do if something's available? Are you going to reject it just to, I don't know, prove that you're tough or something? I mean, I don't think the people...
That's called asceticism?
Yeah. I don't think the people, you know, the settlers, you know, exploring the wilderness, the American wilderness, they, I don't think they lived like that because they wanted to. It was just, you know, what they had to deal with. So I'm not apologizing for any modern comfort I enjoy.
No, I actually had experience with that growing up. I had taken a trip out to Oregon, and all I had was a caravan and a family. And it was really a daunting trip. Occasionally, I would be able to stop at a market and buy some stuff or hunt, but my children got dysentery and different things. It was very trying, and it was I finally, when I crossed the Columbia, I knew I was about to make it there. I had to ford the river. It's all I could afford.
Every time I've tried to ford the river, I drown.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like a great idea, but you know my family was just full of dysentery, and I felt like we needed to get there. We didn't have a lot of supplies.
Sometimes you don't have many options.
Yeah, and I mean we were all just little green people on an Apple II C or E. I can't remember, but I do remember just the stress that did cause. I probably would have taken a train should it have been available.
Yeah. You know, it would have made that game a lot more boring.
Game.
Though,
game. This was virtual reality for me.
Wade's showing his age now because when I went bison hunting, it was in full color. I didn't have green people. I don't even know this world he's talking about.
No, see, did they still have the green horse racing game? We had Oregon Trail. Where in the world is
Carmen San Diego?
Carmen San Diego. And then we had the horse racing where the little green horses. I remember, you know, playing that at school in computer class, and we'd have our little secret bets. I grew up going to the horse race track, you know. So, you know, it was that was an exhilarating game, but they're just moving like, you know, so slow. It was hard to tell what's going to happen. But I don't think it's right to travel the Oregon Trail in color. They didn't have color back then, did
they?
That's
right.
I believe everyone at that point was still colorblind.
You know, I heard there's an interesting like. Label that I heard for kind of this micro generation between Generation X and Generation and the Millennials. That it was called, so combining X and Millennials is Xennials, right? So spelled with an X. But when I was reading this article about this, and I would fall into that area, there was another suggestion made, and it was the Oregon Trail generation. And I thought, well, that's fitting. That hits the mark because everyone, you know, who grew up went to, you know, school at grade school at the same time as me, remembers that game. One computer usually in the back of the room, go and play the game on a floppy disk. And, you know, that was the reason to stay after school.
See, again, these guys are quite a bit older than me. When I was playing computer games in the back of the classroom, they were on the CD-ROMs that were, for some reason, inside of a plastic case. It wasn't just the disk. It was like these floppy disks. I've heard of them.
I despise the CDs because CDs came and ruined my cassette collection. You haven't lived until you've stuck a pencil in a cassette to try to rewind it after it's been all caught up in your cassette player.
Those are the hard times of life. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, now...
So getting CD back to the main topic, when we talk about modern comforts, it sounds like we're comparing the comforts of today with the comforts of the early 1990s. I thought we were taking a little... broader approach here, but
I will say,
you mean like the 1980s?
Yeah, something.
I will say one of the things that I am glad that we have addressed in modernity is is dysentery, is that cured now? Or I don't know, I've known anybody who has, like, it, I mean, in the first world, is that still a thing, or is that
not anyone that I know? But
I don't even know how you get probably bad water or Taco Bell or something, or I don't know. I'm guessing it was bad water, huh?
That would be my guess. Most things come from bad water. The one thing that you have to have, and then it kills you.
You have to have water?
I had a friend who in college hiked the entire Appalachian Trail, and I want to say he got dysentery, but maybe not.
I wonder if it was from the water. I'm guessing it was...
I don't know if it's still a thing. I'm going to look like a...
I mean, I think like if I went to somewhere... else, like, you know, third world or whatever, and I'm not going to say a third world country because I'll offend someone. I don't, Ohio, maybe, I guess, but I'm just joking. We got to come back to that later.
We'll have to come back to Ohio, yeah.
But I'm guessing it's like leprosy. It's mostly gone most places, but I don't. Anyways, I'm glad it's gone.
Yeah, spreads through contaminated food or water, and. Fewer than 200,000 cases in the U.S. per year. So, I mean, it's very much still around, but it's just, I think it's...
I'd like to avoid it. I'm going to make that a life goal.
I guess I didn't have that on my list, but I'll add that to my life
goal. We need to, maybe
list.
When we get Dr. Henkel on, we can do it, but I think a good free-for-all would be diseases you least want to get. Ebola's up there for me. I will just maybe, as we get ready to wrap up the free-for-all, I am a man of my word, and... we noticed that, I believe it was today, Ohio overtook Alaska by 2 downloads. And I had promised if Ohio did overtake Alaska, I would say some nice things about Ohio. And so I've been trying to think of what I can say. I think the first thing I want to say is thanks a lot, Alaska. I think the world of you, but I'm a little bit disappointed at the moment. And so I am expecting some downloads to ease my pain. I'm going to say the landscape is sometimes nice in Ohio. There's some nice rivers. It's hillier, I think, for the most part than Michigan and Wisconsin, except for western Wisconsin.
They have the world record for simultaneous release of balloons.
I think that's nice. They have
I guess it was 1986, and it was a small natural disaster.
That didn't go so well.
They have a, what's the flag? Finley, is that the city of flags? And I like flags. I'm a big supporter.
Akron is the city of rubber, right? I mean, they make the rubber tires.
And I like tires, too. So
good.
It's not Illinois. It's got that going for it.
And I'll say
Illinois may not be in Illinois for much longer.
Yeah,
right?
Do we own that yet or not? I don't know if that's...
I don't know. I haven't heard the final decision there.
I think I can say honestly, too. A buddy of mine had a bachelor party years back, and... so we went to watch the Lions play the Browns, and we don't need any jokes there. It was the down years for both of them, and we don't need jokes about down years either. I realize we may still be in them. But we stayed downtown, and then we went to a game. And I will say Cleveland's downtown was actually very fun, and I enjoyed the stadium and the fans. So there are some nice things about Ohio. I tried to avoid sarcasm, and hopefully I kept my word. To our listeners,
the Browns fans, you enjoyed?
They were nice enough. Yeah,
really.
Yeah,
I've heard that they do like nasty, like they put the batteries and the snowballs and throw them at players.
It was at one of the drunker stadiums I've been in, But even that wasn't angry drunk. It was really friendly drunk. So
like they'd given up.
Well, it was the Lions and Browns, and we had actually just picked up Jeff Garcia after the Browns had him, and I think it was like a 6-3 game the Lions won or something. It was just it was just brutal. But we, and that may have been a 1-15 or a 2-14 season for my Leones. So it was a big W, and we got to be part of it. But I think with that, maybe we've gone a little long on the free-for-all, but that tends to be what we do sometimes. Why don't we make our way into the main topic? Brings us to our main topic for today. Just talking about what is it to be a confessing church? What it is to have a good confession to hold forth for the world. In Christian worship, the Wisconsin Synod hymnal, hymn 541, and Christian worship sometimes likes to adapt verses, so this verse may be different from what you have in other Lutheran hymnals. but what we have in there for verse 6, Nicholas Selnecker has obviously originally in the German, I would suppose, "The cause is yours, the glory too, so hear us, Lord, and keep us true. Your word alone is our defense, the church's glorious confidence." And I was working on a piece recently. It may come out over at 1517, the Legacy Project, where I sometimes have blog posts. You can check that out if you would like at some point. or we may put it up at the Let the Bird Fly website. I do need to get some more written content up there. Peter has about 9 or 10 things in the hopper too that you should be excitedly looking for in the very near future. But working on the idea of what is it to be a confessing church, and what is it to be a church that lives by the word, that has the word as its defense, and then in Christ and the gospel has its true confidence. And so, kind of working our way through here, we were just going to hit on a couple of the ideas I have in there, and the guys are free to disagree with me, although they would be wrong if they do. but one of the things that I hit on is a confessing church is a confident church. And what I mean by that is not necessarily that the Christian walks around with a bunch of swagger, you know, like a Dallas Cowboy receiver, or, you know, I'm trying to think of another team that, I don't know, Cubs center fielder, but that the church is a confident church, a confessing church is a confident church because its confidence is not found in itself. And I'm not talking necessarily here just about parishes, but about church in general as a concept, gathering of believers across geographic lines. A confessing church is a confident church because it recognizes that its confidence and its hope comes in Christ crucified for sinners. And so while Paul talks about making a defense, a confessing church is not a church on the defensive, right? It's not living on fear. It's not a church that is constantly frightened that it's going to be brought out of existence, that it will not survive whatever might be thrown its way. But its confidence is that it's a gathering of sinners for whom Christ died, and this changes everything. It both stops mouths, the mouths of those who would worry or accuse it, but then opens mouths as we sing one at the beginning of Vespers or Matins, "O Lord, open my lips, and my mouth shall declare your praise." I'm getting these confused now in my head. But it's a church whose mouth has been opened by Christ. And then with that, the thing I get into there next, building off of that, and then I'll leave some room for Peter or Ben to comment if they'd like, is that a confessing church is not immersed in or awash in the culture. That is, it's not overtaken by the culture. It's not defined by the culture. It's not inseparable from the culture. And I think this is a challenge in our day. but it is attuned to the culture. Now, we have a particular temptation when we feel the culture maybe isn't going our way to withdraw or to, you know, we're only going to read what our circles put out, or we're only going to interact with those who share our beliefs in every way. And we do have a responsibility, as we've talked about in earlier episodes, to be able to communicate with the culture as a whole. And I think it's interesting that many who will complain about the culture today are themselves the most immersed in a culture, namely in the culture of the bygone past, maybe Victorian ideals, maybe the Christianity of the early 20th century, where things could just be taken for granted, where there were certain what were held to be Christian values that it was thought that at least people in society shared, even if they weren't in church, where mom and dad, even if they didn't come to their divine service, dropped their kids off for Sunday school, where it can be very hard for people to separate the Christian confession from these cultural things that maybe they've just taken for granted.
Yeah, that reminds me of in the last episode with Dr. Merritt, and he was talking about being aware of cultures and being able to see that. And one of the dangers that that I see in myself, at least, is the blind spots, and those are often cultural blind spots. When I think, well, this is just the way it is, right? I haven't actually thought through it, but it's easy to hold that opinion and that position because that's what my culture accepts. That, so yeah, when you think about going back to like a Victorian, you know. Way of life, like there are some wonderful things about that, but just because it was Victorian doesn't make it wonderful, right? And so having that kind of critical lens that Dr. Merritt was talking about in this way is very helpful, because it allows you to see your own blind spots.
And I think even then, when we read, you know, sometimes people will say, well, what do we need new theology for if we've got the theology of our fathers and things of this nature? And I'm a historian, so I love reading the theology of our fathers, and in no way am I negating that. But we can sometimes read the theology of our fathers as if they're writing or living in our own day, and forget that they had their own context for what they were stressing and why. And also, you know, you read, for instance, August Pieper's, Franz Pieper's Dogmatics, and he is engaging the thought of his day. You know, he is immersed in or very fluent with general theological thought, or, you know, cultural shifts, political ideas, things of this nature. And yet we can kind of turn inwards and buckle down and decide, okay, we've got Pieper, we've got all we need, when Pieper sure. himself was not operating in that fashion.
No, I think that's one of the hardest things to do is that, I mean, when you're trying to engage the issues of the day in an honest way, to not be swept away by them either. And, you know, so we're always, I don't know, this reminds me of Luther's Drunken Horseman, right? That you're kind of falling off one side to the other. You're, you know, like, I don't want to be too, you know, modern right now, but I, you know, but then you say, well, I don't want to be too, you know, dusty, crusty, old, whatever, falling back and forth between the two.
I'm not familiar. What's a horseman?
It's half horse, half man, with legs.
I just didn't get the analogy.
I think
making.
It's a centaur that's become inebriated.
Maybe I should use the word rider, a horse rider. Is that better?
I think, don't people get around on cars?
And I'm assuming that this drunken horseman was not a peasant.
Yeah, well,
because
I mean,
the
clearly,
peasant
right?
didn't even have shoes.
Yeah, he would be hoping just for a
middle
couple
nobility,
slabs of
a
leather.
Man of middle nobility,
okay,
who
yeah.
owns a horse,
uh-huh.
who has gone out to the local tavern.
Sure.
Whether intentionally or not, imbibed too much, uh-huh. Is now making his way home and is having trouble not falling off one side or the other side of the horse as he overcompensates.
So as he falls off one side and gets back on and then falls off the other side. And yeah, but of course, probably middle nobility. If you were wealthier, he would have a carriage, and so he wouldn't fall out of that, hopefully.
And I would imagine there was even like different models of horses too, like with automobiles, like an XL or
sure, and
know.
Maybe like an electric.
Yeah, although that would be nice. The just kind of charge those babies. You wouldn't need all the hay or
yeah, well, and
straw.
all the carbon emissions.
Yeah,
is that methane emissions? That's what it is.
Yeah, that's with cows. I'm imagining that horses emit something similar.
Similar, yeah.
Based on the limited research I've done at petting zoos, and things of the like. But no, I agree with Peter that, you know, the temptation can be to overreact the other way. And I think sometimes this comes up too, and so things shift. And if we overreact the other way, we're sometimes overreacting at the expense of very real people, and very real people who need the gospel. And so if we don't understand what are their big concerns, what are their big worries, where are they at, culturally, we have a very hard time articulating the message. And you think of this tension already in the early church, you know, Tertullian, what does Athens have to do with Jerusalem? Should the church be learning philosophy? Should the church's theologians be engaging in the intellectual dialogue of Greco-Roman culture? And, you know, those who won out said, well, of course, although, albeit with caution now, did Plato make his way into the church a little bit? Sure.
Maybe more than a little.
Yeah, just a tiny, a tad bit. You know, even Augustine, you know, one of the best confessors, you get to a lot of theology of the body stuff, and Neoplatonism is hard not to detect, you know. But I do think we do a disservice when we don't see the culture as a representation of both what's best and worst in human beings. This is fallen human beings who nevertheless have, as human creatures, as God creatures, an amazing capability of producing and creating and striving. And so being able to recognize both of those things in that.
Yeah, well, you know, as you said, Wade, being conscious or attuned to culture and to the world, that, you know, some listeners might be asking, well, why does it matter? Why not, you know, fall back into a reclusive position or whatever? But as we talk about a confessing church, what is it fundamentally that a confessing church is doing? It's, well, confessing, I would assume, right? And if it's confessing, certainly we confess, you know, so that, you know, that confession, I think, has a way of strengthening your own faith. And I mean, there's something reflexive about it in that way. But we also confess so that others hear it, right? And in that way, the confession, you know, is for others as well, right? It's going outward. And if it's going outward, well, then we need to know who's out there, right? We need to be attuned to that culture so that we can speak to them, so that at the very least they can understand why they disagree with us.
And I think, you know, it's interesting that some of those who would most quickly pull back from anything that wasn't explicitly Christian, whether it be literature, music, whatever the case might be, can also be those who are going to most double down on reflecting the culture in other odd ways, you know, polo shirts and you know, fancy, you know, fashionable get up or whatever the case may be. I don't want to say too much and get people upset, but, you know, we'll take very visual aspects of the culture while failing to actually be able to speak to and engage the very underpinnings or the intellectual or and by intellectual here, I don't mean just intellectuals doing this, but just what is behind our thought that we don't even recognize, the assumptions, the presuppositions, and the big questions of people in their own day. And you know, so that can be interesting. And then sometimes you'll have on the other side people who consciously or unconsciously are not dressing very cultural. We think of the historic clothing of many in the church, whether it be the vestments or clerical collar, things of this nature, and I'm not saying this is the only way to do ministry, and this is coming from a guy who basically looks like a homeless guy outside of, you know, when I'm preaching or whatever else. But, you know, but at the same time, those people whose dress may look countercultural are oftentimes those who are actively sitting and engaging with the thought of the culture at large. And not to, I don't want to beat a big drum here, not to win the culture. This drives me nuts. Yeah, that we want to win point. The culture. The church has never done well when it's won the culture, right? This is not the goal at all. The goal is that the gospel will lay claim to Christians, and then these Christians will then serve in their vocations in the culture, the unbaptized culture that's necessarily built so that all who live and work within it can have some measure, hopefully we would hope as Christians, some measure of peace and prosperity and opportunity. So that the goal of engaging the culture doesn't mean let's make a Christian culture. And we referenced the 90s earlier, and I think this was one of the great follies of the 90s, was especially among evangelicals, capital E evangelicals, but not Lutheran evangelicals, really made it their goal. We're going to win the culture and win the culture for Christ.
Well, it's even going so far as to call it culture wars, right?
Exactly. And I really do hope if we are going to be in a culture war that we lose it, because the culture tends to conquer the church when that happens.
Well, and I think the article, blog post, whatever you want to call it, you wrote, did a nice job talking too about how there's a message that's cross-cultural for the confessing church, and regardless of the culture, it's a message everybody needs to hear, and that's Christ crucified. And I think the temptation can sometimes, on the other hand, on the one hand, we might try to pull back from the culture and kind of separate ourselves from it, and then we aren't engaging with fellow people who need to hear the word. But on the other side too, we can try so hard to make our message indistinguishable from the main culture, mm-hmm. that we really aren't doing the most important thing we need to, and that's distinctly preaching Christ crucified.
And I think, that's a huge point or a huge thing to consider, is how even our language can become a wash-in rather than attuned to the culture. When the church loses its vocabulary, it can get in big trouble, and that will be another episode on language, maybe the importance of that too, that, concepts tend to find words. and I don't know, Peter's going to correct me on, philosophical schools here, but we can get to that in another one. But I think it's very important to remember, how are we expressing ourselves as we do so. One of the other things I have here, and this is one that may not be popular with everyone, but that is the confessing church is more worried about souls than institutional bottom lines or the local budget or family names or anything of this nature. That the church is given for sinners, that it may proclaim the gospel, may call to repentance, but then give the consolation of the gospel. And I think Christians of any sort can easily fall into the temptation of thinking that their Christianity is about keeping their institution alive. I hate to go back to Kierkegaard all the time, but, this is something...
Do you?
Yeah, I somewhat, but, he saw kind of this, speaking of culture, how, the state church had kind of just taken on this cultural Christianity, and it was about the state church, right, about making sure we meet the budget and we're respected, that pastors are, held up as important civil servants or things of this nature. And we can do that on any level, whether we a parish level or a synodical level or a diocesan level, whatever the case may be, where the survival of the institution can almost become more important than the survival of the lost soul. And so that we remember in the end, whatever happens with buildings or with names in the directory or our people, whoever our people might be, the ultimate gift the church has always handed down at its best is the confession of Christ and Him crucified. And that some of the most wonderful confessions of that faith came out of times where the church was challenged to articulate its confession well, maybe even persecuted. And so that even when there's someone outside of our fellowship, whatever your church body and fellowship might be, when they're confessing Christ, that we can rejoice and not think it is the sole prerogative of our whatever our circle is to do so, but to realize that while we have differences and important differences, and there must be differences, as Christ says, there must be divisions among you to show that which is true, that we can rejoice with Paul when Christ is proclaimed, and sometimes in a way that we can glean a lot from and how well someone does so.
No, and another reason here why I think being a confessing church is so important is that you identify those differences, not simply to draw the division and mark in a void, but rather to, you know, seek ultimately for, you know, some, you know, unity where it's possible, of course, right? There is but one faith, right? And that's what we look for. So even in that moment, being a confessing church, if you sit back, rest on your haunches and say, well, we'll just kind of pretend like we all agree here, you're missing the opportunity to actually have those conversations. So as you're, you know, going forward in love, looking at souls, you also are able to, you know, confess clearly so that you can identify those differences and have those conversations, those tough conversations.
And that's where the confidence comes in, that you're sharpening your confession in doing so. If we really do think we have the right, the proper confession, why in the world wouldn't we want to go out and engage? Why in the world wouldn't we want to take that to whoever we could? You know, sometimes you'll hear people who are very nervous about, you know, reading authors maybe from outside of certain circles. And if you really do think that you have one of the best worker training systems in the world and that you have the true, the right, the proper confession, why in the world wouldn't we be confident to go out with it? And I think sometimes it, in my own life even, when I get nervous to engage something, maybe in the back of my mind it is, well, do I know, am I scared to have my beliefs challenged? And if I am, that can be one of two things. Maybe it's a problem with my beliefs, or maybe it's simply a problem with my understanding of them. And so sometimes iron sharpens iron, if we really are confident in the message we have, obviously with due respect to every biblical doctrine, and to concerns of fellowship, but we will want to be able to take that confession to as many as possible. I don't know if that makes sense, but I'm thinking that out loud. I think another thing I hit on in here is that confessing church is a listening church. The problem with this is I know myself as a pastor. I'm a much better talker than listener, and the parish kind of had to teach me to listen because there's times where it just becomes clear that's your job because someone comes in your office and starts talking. But I think sometimes we can be tempted to think that, you know, because the gospel is preached, that gospel ministry is pretty much just talking. But I think the importance of understanding and listening where people are at so that we can properly apply law and gospel is something that's especially important in our own day, especially as we talked about technology. Perhaps meaningful relationships, while we can have more friends than ever before, are more difficult than ever before. I know as a pastor many brother pastors, you know, it's a real challenge to see your people outside of the hour on Sunday morning, to be involved in their lives, to get in their houses, you know, not like to rob them or anything, but to talk, to be at their kids' sports games, to be in the neighborhood. I know some, you know, bristle at the thought to go to the neighborhood tavern where your members are hanging out, whatever the case may be, or the coffee shop, and to be able to just listen. And I know for myself, there's always the temptation, oh, they said something that's not 100% act, I need to correct them. You know, I'm in the elevator in the hospital and someone sees me in a clerical collar and they say it means the, you know, the world to them, just that there's someone there that represents God and hope for them. And so I talk to them and maybe they say something that's not quite theologically correct. That's probably not the point for me to go, actually, you know, the hypostatic union, whatever the case may be. But to be able to listen to where they're at and then apply law and gospel in ways that are appropriate for that setting. I think especially as just the, and I've talked about the sky is falling, the general tenor of discussion in many people's lives has shifted to where we go in with just a general suspicion of anyone who might not think like us anyways. It's a special gift for a confessing church to have, to be willing to listen to those to whom it is confessing.
And that really ties back to being attuned to culture. You can't understand the world around you. You can't understand the people, right? That's what we're really worried about. If you're not listening, that's the first, you know, the first step. But it is also interesting. You have this, almost sounds paradoxical. The confessing church is a listening church, right? So in listening, knowing better how to confess, how to articulate.
Well, and if you even just look at Jesus' preaching and teaching ministry, how often did he... yes, the message of law and gospel is universal, still is today. Everybody needs to hear it, and everybody needs to hear it the same. But even Jesus himself knew, you know, how people needed to hear the message, what would, depending on their situation in life, depending on what sin they were struggling with, depending on what sickness they were struggling with, knew how to preach the law to them in a extremely, you know, powerful way, or preach the gospel to them in an extremely powerful way. And because none of us are Jesus and we don't know those things innately, the only way we can find out about our fellow people is by listening to them and finding out what their situation is in life, and maybe when they confess what, you know, particular struggles with sin they're having, or what doubts they're having with their faith and that kind of thing. And that, again, only comes by listening to them.
And that, I hate to lend credence to Peter's reading of the Gospels, but you think of, what is it, John 4, right, the Samaritan woman, how, you know, Jesus draws out from her current situation. So then he can then apply both law but also grace to it, and then she becomes this great evangelist, right, going back into the village and saying, come out and come to this person who told me, you know, told me everything I've ever known or done or whatever the case may be. And I think of how often in the parish, sometimes what really I think made people comfortable coming to me in the future, or just wanting the person they saw as the representative of Christ there, certainly not in appearance or piety, but by calling, was this is someone I've sat with and they've listened. They've listened to my struggles. They've listened to my sins. And that is what made them comfortable. And so just me being there by the hospital to bed to them spoke forgiveness, because they knew that even when they had come at their most vulnerable, and not because of me, I always viewed it as they're confessing to God, not to me, but to God. It just became a reminder of the gracious presence of God, even though he was speaking through someone who oftentimes had no clue what the right thing to say was, you know, and things of this nature, especially early in ministry. And so I think that does bear out with Jesus, and I guess I'll concede none of us are Jesus. But yeah, what he knew innately, we do well to get to know through conversation, and not fearful conversation. They might say something wrong. What if they've committed some big sin? Shouldn't we be glad if it comes out that they've committed some sin that we can then address? How many more opportunities don't we have today where sin is maybe less hidden, as people are frightened of appearances, and it's more out in the open to be discussed and addressed?
Well, no, I mean, as Lutherans, we know that, you know, everyone has a big sin, and many big sins, countless big sins, and so for them to come out...
Can you list three for yourself, Peter? Or can I guess?
Well, you have to put the collar on, and we need to turn the mics off.
All right, I'll be back in a little bit. I have a collar right behind you, actually.
You do, I noticed that. Yeah, I should be careful what I say here.
Collar with the Greenfield Hawks baseball shirt. It would be a good
and
combo.
A West Dallas Wolves fast hat. Pitch hat, yeah. I even have blue stoles, blue Honolulu blue and silver. Actually, it's a lion scarf, but I think it would still work. Sorry, keep going, Peter.
Place that over your hand. And, no, I don't even remember what I was saying. Oh, everyone's a sinner, right? Except for this guy. No, we know that everyone's a sinner. So when those sins come out, when those, you know, especially the big ones where, you know, someone is kind of putting that out there, that's a wonderful opportunity. I think that's, you know, one of the great reasons for private confession and absolution is that those can come out, and that the gospel message and the absolution can be truly offered. And as you were saying, Wade, it's not you offering it. You're just the tool that God's using. I mean, it's going through you, but it's Christ's absolution. It's the Father's forgiveness that's being proclaimed.
One of the things I pick up next in here, and we won't belabor the whole thing, is that a confessing church is a church that doesn't need a plan, or at least not as much of a plan as many times people think. One of the things that I'm glad it seems to be kind of on the tail end was all the huge emphasis on planning and mission and vision and, you know, all of these things. We're going to, by this year, are going to do this, and, you know, we're going to... I hate meetings, and... As I sometimes tell colleagues, the Holocaust started in a meeting. Everybody always thinks great things come of meetings, but I don't really know if that's true. But, you know, sometimes even Christians can think, okay, what's my plan for living for Christ and sharing Christ? And sometimes you'll hear people even, you know, preachers might say, write down 7 things you're going to do for Jesus. And I'm always tempted to write eat, sleep, drink, talk, you know, and everything. But what the church has, rather than all these detailed plans, and you have to plan something. Someone has to pay the electric bill. You know, you have to decide, you know, who's going to be altar guild or whatever the case may be. But what it does have, more importantly than plans, is vocations. And one of the, I think, positive developments I'm seeing in some churches is that we're getting rid of this impression that if you're not at church all the time, if you're not busy at church, that you're less of a member. Sometimes I'd have to tell members, go home. Serve God there. You've done enough here. If the lawn doesn't get mowed as much as you'd like, someone will see it, and it'll be an opportunity for them to serve, or it will get extra long, and we'll be reminded that God made grass, and grass grows, or whatever the case may be, or I'll cut it. But we have vocation. And so the main way that Christians serve as salt and light is in the ways that God has called them, not by another meeting necessarily, although some meetings are necessary, but that we have been given vocation. And so sinners come and we declare them saints, and we send them home washed in the blood of the Lamb and righteous with Christ's righteousness. And then they get to go serve parents as bishop and apostle to their children. Children as those who also offer forgiveness to their parents, those of us who are parents know how often that occurs, as fellow employees or employers who strive to be faithful in their work and take advantage of the opportunities that come up to talk about the reason for the hope that they have, whatever the case may be, and not by being at the same time cornally Christian. You know, they don't have to have a cross on every shirt they wear or a mug with a Bible verse or be listening to, you know, whatever rock band couldn't make it as a real rock band. And
it sounds like you're describing Ned Flanders.
Yeah, it could be. you know, but this, but just as Christians in the places in which God has placed them, and there's a confidence in that too. I'm not fretting then, who did I tell about Jesus today? Rather, I lived for Christ that day, the only way I can live, in the forgiveness of sins, and Jesus will use that as he sees fit. In fact, I think there's even a Bible verse that gets quoted a lot that ends with the good works that he has prepared in advance for us to do. It's just oftentimes we don't like those. Maybe that's for my students listening to their roommate when they need someone to listen. Maybe the good work prepared in advance is, you know, me going home and vacuuming, which isn't happening. But but you know, there's these things that we may not see as attractive as going on some mission trip and playing soccer with poor kids and going swimming, but in and of themselves are still how Christ is serving our neighbor through us. And we will, I'm going to be going to the Brewers game tomorrow, Lord willing, with our new theology professor here at the college, Dr. Mike Berg. And I do plan on taking a sign, stop pitchers batting or something along those lines, hashtag letthebirdfly.com. We need to have him on sometime on vocation, because he is just fantastic on explaining that. This in a meaningful way too, not in a kind of a superficial way.
Yeah, I like to just talk about it superficially, but yeah, that's something he's thought a lot about, I think, and I've had the same thought. That'd be a good thing to have him on for.
Any thoughts on vocation, just as two gentlemen who maybe are not serving in called positions in the church, but are certainly serving in a variety of what we might consider, called, you know, Baruch vocatio, called out ways.
I just think in terms of, you know, the work of the confessing church, I've been a member of a number of different congregations and just been in, you know, talk to people who are members of different congregations. And unfortunately, it's very easy for people to talk about the particular, you know, non-essential things that they either really like or don't like about their pastor, and he does this well or he doesn't do this so well. And, you know, when we talk about vocation in the church, the vocation of the pastor is to preach that word. And if he's doing that faithfully, that is really a gift to every single member of that congregation, whether you like how he dresses or you think he's too introverted or you think he's too extroverted or whatever other, you know, non-important things might be there.
No, and I'll say that vocation is something that I've thought about for a long time as I was going through college and doing a lot of theology, and it obviously comes up. But it was when I became a father that it really kind of hit home. Like, it wasn't just a text anymore. It wasn't just in a book. It wasn't just a doctrine, that it was something very real.
It was a baby.
It was a baby, yeah.
That you had no thought of eating because it was so darn cute.
Yeah, exactly. Too cute to eat. Yeah. No, and I think I mentioned I was driving home from the hospital, right? I mean, I was terrified. But that's the thing when it really hit me, and I kind of got it on a little bit I don't want to say deeper level, because it's not that. That's the only way that I understand it. But it was just present right in front of me. You know, babies cry in the middle of the night, and you got to deal with it. There's no one else to do it, so you're kind of forced to kind of keep on doing that. And then you start realizing, wow, I've got to, you know, baby's baptized now. I've got to train the baby up. You know, I need to teach her, in my case, all girls. I've got to teach her how to, you know what it means to be a Christian. Teach her what her baptism means, and that she remains in that baptismal grace her whole life. And that is a heavy vocation, an important vocation to bear. And then it kind of breaks out into other places. Well, where else do I have these callings in life that maybe I was less attuned to in the past?
And I think there was a sign someone had once that kind of bothered me of, you know, if you don't want to focus on school, that's all right, you can flip burgers. And I sometimes bring up in ethics, the guy flipping burgers is actually probably serving his neighbor much better than many of you will be in whatever job you get, you know, investment banking or whatever else. Now, don't get me wrong, you're still serving your neighbor by making money off money, which Luther was, of course, very leery of.
As most people in that time period were.
Yeah, but what is that guy flipping burgers doing? He's feeding even the least of these. God is using him to serve his neighbor. And, you know, I think in Germany, where Luther's doctrine of vocation took hold, even though the church doesn't have near the influence it had in the past, you still see that in the value they take in many of their occupations. And so, yeah, it is. And through your children, you're serving your neighbor in generations to come by raising a child to be a good neighbor to them. I think to kind of wrap up, based on the blog post, one of the things I want to close with is how Christ reminds us that we are a confessing church and what we are to confess. And this is namely by, especially in my case, calling sinful men into the office of preacher, that those who know their sins are compelled to proclaim the church's message for both their own salvation and their hearers. And so Paul says, watch your life and doctrine closely. This is not to say that God calls sinners to be open and public sinners and not repentant, or to say that there's not things that disqualify people from the office. But it is to say that it's a message that the Christian pastor, and then I think also Christian lay people, are compelled to proclaim or to inculcate in the home or wherever they are, because it's how they live and breathe and have their being, and once again it gets back to their confidence. And so I kind of close the piece by saying that confessing church is the only good church, and that only by the imputed righteousness of Christ. That we remember that the confessing church can be confident, it can be hopeful, it can be attuned to the culture, it can be confident in how it acts as salt and light in its vocation, because all of its confidence and hope rests outside of itself in Christ. That imputed righteousness, meaning that righteousness is now credited to us through faith, which is also then God's own gift, which comes to us through word and sacrament. And so, if we're honest with ourselves, there should never be a day where we forget what the church is there to give, because if we look at the law, if we examine ourselves honestly at night, how can we not remember our greatest need, and also then where we find that consolation that allows us to maybe get a few hours of sleep, even on the days of crises, and that enables us, as said in what, Psalm 4, verse 8, I'm thinking, used to use that one a lot, I will lie down and sleep in peace, for you alone, O Lord, make me dwell in safety. That imputed, that credited righteousness of Christ is where we find the confidence and the compulsion to go and engage. So I don't know how clear I've been or how well I've addressed the content of the blog post or article. Hopefully we've made sense. But anything, Peter and Ben, to add on any of that? Or I think ultimately, hopefully, people listening, we want to do a lot with the podcast. We talk about a lot of topics. But one of the things, especially when we get to theology or to the church, is to be reminding people what I know for me personally, and I would suspect for the three gentlemen in this room, it's true of all of us, is the thing that enables us to get up in the morning and to serve in the various vocations God gives and to even get in front of microphones and take a chance that someone might listen, which is the freedom that is given to us by knowing that life is something that is given to us, that it is gift, that it's not our own in a way that depends on us, but it is our own in Christ our Savior who came to save sinners. And so how can we not confess? Now, not every episode, as you know, is all Christianity all the time, and we even sometimes have a high church Anglican on. But the confidence to want to go out and engage, because what we have is just a treasure beyond any measure, which namely freedom. Freedom from sin, freedom from appearances, freedom from all that would tie down, to live and be and speak and serve in Christ our Lord, not for salvation, but as those who are saved. Any thoughts, gentlemen?
No, I just encourage anybody, if they're interested, to read the paper or the blog or whatever you want to call it. It's real short, whether it goes up at the 1517 or on the Let the Bird Fly site. But I think it does a nice job of really putting together the points of what we've been talking about.
Yeah, and just to be clear, it's not up yet, but it will be, at some point for sure. And when it does, we'll link it. So take a look at that, definitely.
And then I guess as we get ready to close out, once again, congratulations to Ohio. We wish you all the best. Thanks for listening. Alaska, it's time to get on your horse and get these downloads speeding up. But in the meanwhile, whatever the case may be, whether you're listening or not, we pray that you are able to let the bird fly.
Every evening when the sun goes down, get with my party and I begin to count. I don't care what the people are thinking, I'm not drunk, I'm just a drinker. I set them up another round, I set them up another round, I set them up another round. One more round won't get me down. And I said, honey, I don't care.